our third episode of Synversations, a podcast that explores the depths of synthetic biology from various multidisciplinary standpoints. I'm David Key, and I will be your host for today. I'm a second-year life sciences student studying nutritional science and global health. Synversations is a five-episode-long podcast created by the University of Toronto Policy and Practices Division of its iGEM team. iGEM is a student association dedicated to the practice of synthetic biology and dissemination of its scientific foundations. In today's episode, we'll be exploring the depths of engineering and its role in synthetic biology. To make this episode extra special, we have Dr. McMillan, who will be interviewed by Katarina.
Please introduce yourself and give us a brief description of what you do.
Okay. My name's David McMillan. I'm a professor at the University of Toronto. I'm in the chemistry department primarily, but I'm cross-appointed to physics and cell and systems biology and biomedical engineering. And I run the Synthetic Biology and Cellular Control Lab, which is based at the University of Toronto, Mississauga. So we're out at the Western campus. We do research on cell-based solutions to problems. And yeah, so there you go.
Could you give us a quick description of what synthetic biology is?
Yeah, so I mean, when I try to define it, I try to say that it's an effort to create an engineering discipline that you can apply in and around living cells. So by analogy to mechanical engineering or electrical engineering that have their own sort of domains, there is a need for sort of systematic approaches to operate on cells and to modify their behavior in controlled ways. So synthetic biology is sort of the ongoing effort to create that discipline. That's the way I think of it.
How did you first come into contact with synthetic biology?
So I visited Jim Collins's group, James J. Collins, when he was at Boston University during my PhD, when he was working on neural systems primarily, and they were just getting into genetic systems. So I was there during my PhD and I did some stuff on neurons and systems of coupled neurons. And then I went back for a postdoc, also in his group, at the Center for Biodynamics, it was called. So right at that time, they were sort of transitioning from working mainly on neurons to working mainly on genes. And so the term didn't exist yet, but I remember a few years later, we heard the term and everyone thought, oh, that's a good name. That's sort of, because there was this new thing that people were doing, but they didn't have a label for it. So maybe an interesting trivia tidbit for your listeners is that the first proposal was to call it genetic applets, which is very old school sounding now. I think the applets was a term in the early 2000s or so for like what we would now call pop-up windows or little JavaScript things that would download on your computer and run. So the idea was, you know, making these little systems that you download onto a cell and they run there. But synthetic biology, that was a good label. Everyone, as soon as we heard that, I thought that's captures a lot of information about what the field should be.
What aspect of synthetic biology first captured your attention?
I guess it was this idea of kind of forward engineering in a cellular context. So the idea that you could, rather than passively observing what a cell is doing, you could actively poke it in sort of increasingly sophisticated ways. So that's an interesting idea. And also, I guess, maybe it's not what first captured my attention, but since then, the idea that you can use it as a real vehicle for solutions. So things that you can create out of cells can be made very cheaply. And that's one of the things that we're particularly interested in the group, is to make cheap solutions to problems. So we can maybe talk about that later when we get, or I don't remember the order of the question.
No. So. And what do you foresee as being the major avenues where synthetic biology can make an impact? Or what real-world applications do you see synthetic biology fulfilling?
So I'll start with my favorite one and then move out from there, I guess. So I think the developing world probably has most to gain in kind of the short to medium term in a lot of ways because of this idea that microbes are cheap, right? If you can grow a solution to something, then you can make a lot of that solution for not very much money. So there's been effort. It's been one of the dreams of synthetic biology from the beginning to sort of make, say, biosensors out of bacteria cells or yeast cells or whatever. And there's been various examples of that. Or cells that attack other cells, right? The cells that can detect, like E. coli that detects Pseudomonas and try to excrete antimicrobials. So our entry on this front lately is a yeast-based system that can be used to screen blood. So it expresses antigens from the surfaces of yeast and then it uses a nice visual simple output to tell you whether the antibodies corresponding to those antigens are present in a blood sample. So the idea is that you can, once you've got the yeast, that's sort of expensive and involves genetic manipulation to make, but once you've got them, you can grow vats of these things for not very much money. And that class of solution seems like something that we might see more and more of over time. I mean, it still has to go from proof of principle to actual deployment, and that's one of the tricks, is to get things from the lab out into the world, but at least lays the groundwork for things that could be made very cheaply. And you know, similar sorts of things with detecting toxins in the environment. You know, anything that you can sense with a cell, you can sense for very little money, and very little money is what people have to work with in a lot of the world. So, but then on other fronts, I mean, there's been exciting work towards detecting, using classifier systems to detect the onset of cancer, or detect, discriminate between cancerous and non-cancerous cells, from the Benison and Weiss groups, for example. That might one day, that's another early dream of synthetic biology that may one day pay off, is the ability to have something that sits inside your cells and decides if they're going cancerous and then kills them. Although, as I always joke, you better be right about that, right? Because if you get that wrong, it's going to just dissolve your body, and that's no good. So you've got to make sure you get that 100% correct. But in principle, if it can detect the onset of cancer, then it can shut that down before it gets started. So there might be a way to cure cancer from the inside, or various other things to do with, medical interventions by programming bacteria. We're actually working on one of those as well with a team here to try to make a probiotic that can reside in the gut and produce therapeutics to try to help inflammatory bowel disease. So, so I think there's going to be medical things. The big success story so far is the artemisinin success that they've had with, re-engineering yeast cells to produce large amounts of this precursor to an anti-malarial drug. Right? So that's already in the field. So I'm sure we'll see more of that because, industry loves to build on success. So hopefully, and for similar reasons, I guess, for this inexpensiveness, right? Cells are very good at making, they're very good organic chemists in a sense, right? So if you can make them do something for you, that's very appealing for industrial applications.
What are some of the challenges that one might face when trying to realize the real world applications of their synthetic biology research?
It's kind of the same for synthetic biology as it is for a lot of science, which is that there's a gap between proof of principle in a dish or in a lab solutions and things out in the real world. Like if you look back at things that were shown as proof of principle 10 or 15 years ago, a lot of them are still proof of principle, right? Or they haven't really gone anywhere. It's not the kind of thing we tend to do because it might be a little embarrassing, right? If we actually went back and looked at all these things that were so exciting a while ago. I think it's partly because as scientists, we don't get any kind of training about what does it take to make a product that you can hand somebody, right? That you could actually. So I've been working with this place called the Impact Center here that is at the University of Toronto, which has as its one of its main focuses is this sort of bridging that gap. So they do training for entrepreneurs. Several of my students have gone through their training program, and the idea is supposed to fill in some of those gaps about, if you want to create a company based on the scientific research you've done, how do you do that? What is market research? How does IP law work? How do you do development of something from an idea into a product? And it turns out we probably, as a group, as scientists, underestimate how hard that is. The merits of that, of the value of that sort of whole process, because we sort of think, well, that's, we've done the hard part, right? This is we've got the thing that does, you can show in a flask that it will detect arsenic or it will do antigen detection. And then the rest will be just kind of ellipsis product, right? But that ellipsis is actually pretty complicated. So I think synthetic biology suffers from that same problem as the rest of, there's plenty of non-biological sensors and things that also have this problem, right? You, in principle, can use a laser to detect something, and then, you need to actually turn that into, some sort of laser-based product that you can sell somebody. So, yeah, I think it's certainly not lacking in attention recently, and I feel like there's more attention being paid to it in Canada recently, so that's good news. That people want to encourage entrepreneurship, and they want to encourage scientists in particular to try to commercialize their products. I used to think of commercialization as kind of a dirty word. It sort of sounds like, violating the purity of science or whatever. And it's actually, commercialization doesn't have to mean that you're trying to become filthy rich. It's actually a label for the process of turning things into reality, right? So like making something into an actual deployed product doesn't have to be, I mean, it can be done by a nonprofit. It doesn't have to be done, you know, with the goal of world domination. It can be done to try to help the world, but it's, I now think of it as like the mechanism by which you bridge that gap and get things out into the world. So I'm hoping that, you know, mm-hmm. some of these student-founded companies that have come out of the lab will be the mechanism by which things get out there and we get from an in-principle yeast detection kit to an actual one.
And what are some of the issues with integrating synthetic biology into real-world applications?
Yeah, I think it's definitely a challenge. In some ways, I see the public's point, right? I mean, there is actually, I always feel like when I have these discussions, I want to make sure that I don't downplay the potential dangers, because sometimes people have discussions where they just completely dismiss the idea that there might be any sort of issue. And mm-hmm. I mean, but at the same time, they're not apocalyptic dangers. I mean, the issue I always see is that if you're out there creating new species and releasing them into the ecosystem, you can make changes that are far more rapid than would ever happen on an evolutionary timescale, mm-hmm. right? So the argument that you're just creating something that you could do by selective breeding, yeah, but that selective breeding would take years or decades or something. And so there'd be a lot more time for the rest of the ecology to adjust around it. We do have kind of an analog for that in the form of invasive species. Like, this is essentially what happens when you bring a new species into an ecosystem and drop it there from a ship or an airplane or something. So it does create problems, right? I mean, you've got zebra mussels in the Great Lakes or whatever, things that have no natural predators, and they start becoming a nuisance, but it's not the end of the world, right? It hasn't sort of taken over and destroyed the ecosystem. So, but it is an actual thing that you have to be aware of. So, I mean, one of the challenges, I guess, is to maybe have, like, I don't know whether that's a useful way to talk to the public. I mean, mm-hmm. in some ways it may be helpful to have a more honest discussion to say, yes, we are aware of the dangers and we're mm-hmm. looking into them and we're paying attention. On the other hand, yeah, I mean, because there definitely are irrational mm-hmm. fears people have. Like, they sort of have this vague sense that, you know, genes are going to escape and take over the world and destroy your crops. And that seems unlikely, but it's definitely, I mean, it seems like that should be a parallel stream in any sort of discussion of real-world applications, is that you should actually be looking into, like, what are the potential downsides. There's been some nice work on sort of non-canonical amino acids to try to fence in mm-hmm. engineered organisms, right? The Church and Isaac's labs have done interesting things on those lines, mm-hmm. but those are hard to explain to the public.
What do you see as one of the major challenges regarding the public's perception of synthetic biology?
I guess one of the challenges, I guess, would be to have people think of synthetic biology solutions as not being the same thing as GMO crops, which have a very mm-hmm. strong publicity problem. And largely with sort of a panic response, I think people have been overreacting to a lot of those concerns. But mm-hmm. yeah, so I guess we have to get to talk to legislators and people who make the rules about these things and maybe try to convince them that there is actually, yeah, there are precautions one can take that make it into an acceptable, that you're managing the risk in an acceptable way. So one thing that will help, I guess, is that when you start having things that are tangible and substantial benefits, then it'll be an easier sell. You can say, yeah. Okay, so maybe you're less worried about this thing once you know that when you swallow it, it'll cure whatever disease you have or whatever, you know, if you have a big upside to yeah. point to, then maybe that helps get over people's worries.
The benefit outweighs the risk.
Yeah, that kind of thing.
Yeah. One of the main focuses of our podcast is discussing how synthetic biology interacts with multiple different disciplines. Can you maybe give us a little bit of an idea as to what kinds of people you've worked with?
Yeah, so I guess I started with that list of all the places I'm cross-appointed, right? So that's one example. So I have people from physical and biological chemistry. I've had biological physicists and physicists who kind of became biological against their will. I haven't had anybody from biomedical engineering yet, but in a sense, we're kind of already all doing biomedical engineering. And then cell and systems biology, so people coming from various branches of that. They're actually taking over the lab, because it seems like lately our focus is such that we're getting more interest from the biologists than we are from the physicists and chemists. So yeah, I mean, so all of those, I run a kind of parallel modeling/theory and experimental mm-hmm. group. So I always try to get people who are doing theory, I try to make them do some experiments. just because it keeps them humble and keeps them sort of grounded. And I think that's become, I think, the standard way. When things started, I think it was pretty standard to have sort of theory only and experiment only groups, and increasingly we're not an anomaly anymore in that sense. Mm-hmm. We have, you know, there's lots of groups that have both. I try to get it to be both in one person if I can, just because I think it's very helpful to have that sort of exposure to, you know, how uncooperative cells actually are compared to your models, and vice versa. I think it's useful to have at least some exposure to the modeling if you're doing experimental work. So people with sort of very mathematical backgrounds, I've been pretty lucky to get quite a few students who are capable of doing both, which is kind of unusual, but mm-hmm. I think maybe it's something about the recruiting effort that when I talk about these things, the people I don't scare away are the ones who sort of end up joining the group. Yeah, it's hard to predict, I guess.
Yeah.
I mean, when I was thinking about this recently, I guess one possibility, and I don't mean this to be a negative thing, but one possibility is that it will cease to exist, mm-hmm. in the sense that, like, as a distinct field rather than if it's sort of toolified, right? If it becomes just a standard approach that you use in other things. I'm thinking about, like, molecular biology, right?
Mm-hmm.
If someone says, I do molecular biology, you then say, on what or for what, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's not like, it's not a field that you just do. It's something that you use as a tool towards something else. And so, in a sense, I think that would be good news if synthetic biology went the same way. It's just
mm-hmm.
that you're studying regulatory pathways in some cell, and synthetic biology is now just one of the things that you obviously do, because rather than perturbing one cell at a time with knockouts, you now make little networks and put them in, and you can do dynamical perturbations. And if it becomes just a tool in the toolbox of a broader effort of biology / biological engineering, that would be kind of like we've made it, right? We've sort of finished the process of creating the discipline, and now it becomes just a thing you do on the way to other things. Like right now, I think we're early enough that we're still developing the tools.
Mm-hmm.
But once those are solid, I don't know whether 20 years is going to be enough time to do that, but one day that may be what actually happens, is that it's not actually, it's something you do as part of a bigger effort.
Mm-hmm.
So that's my, yeah, I guess that might be my speculative answer, I guess. I mean, and then the answer to what it might be doing depends on what biological engineering more broadly is doing, I guess, what kind of problems are being addressed. And yeah, so 20 years sounds like a long time, but I suspect we'll still be, hopefully we're not still calling it an emerging field by then, but it will still be, I'm sure there's plenty of work, certainly to keep me busy for the rest of my career, but maybe to keep you guys busy for yours as well.
What inspires you to continue researching within the field of synthetic biology?
So I touched on this before, I guess, this potential to lead to applications. So I've become increasingly application interested.
Mm-hmm.
I've had now 3 Grand Challenges Canada grants that are all about things for the developing world,
mm-hmm.
and that's really sort of changed my way of thinking about these things. I guess that's what really sort of inspires me, is the idea that we can try to use cells to solve problems out in the real world. And the reason I keep mentioning that maybe it's not by synthetic biology is that in some cases it's not, right? It doesn't,
mm-hmm.
like the stuff with the yeast, it's sort of, there's no networks involved. So sometimes I get asked, is that synthetic biology? And I'm like, I don't really care. I mean, it's sort of, I'm not going to put in a regulatory control network just because I can, right? If you can solve a problem without it, that's kind of the engineering attitude, right? Is you do as little as possible to solve the problem in front of you. I'm fascinated by synthetic biology, but I guess it's a sense, maybe I'm making this transition I talked about earlier in my head already, is I see it as one possible route towards solving things. But yeah, my wife's from the Philippines, so I spend a fair bit of time in Southeast Asia, and when I see, it's just appalling to me, the idea that we're this far into the 21st century, and so many people are not partaking of the results of our technological progress, that, you know, if anything I can do to help some people somewhere is what keeps me interested.
Thank you for joining us on this rainy day.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thanks very much.
That concludes our third segment of the podcast, Synversations. Don't forget to check us out on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and igemtoronto.ca. We will see you next time with our episode on arts and communications.